All right. Hello and welcome to Great Things with Great Tech, episode 5. My name is Anthony Spiteri, and this podcast is all about highlighting companies doing great things with great tech. And in this episode, we're talking to Sergey Brody, Chief Technology Officer of Weber. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. Really enjoy the opportunity.
Just like your name, like obviously me being Australian, I see it and I pronounce it in the way that I think. But how do you pronounce your name properly so I can get it right and not butcher it?
Well, thanks for asking. It's pronounced Siggy.
Siggy. Okay, yeah. There you go. You wouldn't have thought that, but it is what it is. So Siggy, that's great. Now I won't butcher it and you won't be angry with me through the rest of the episode as we go along.
Forget,
I know,
you
I know how that minutes. Feels.
If you forget in 10 minutes, you can ask again. No hard feelings there.
Yeah, I shouldn't forget. We should be good. So just before we get into the crux of the episode and talk about Weber, I just wanted to remind everyone listening out there that, you know, we've got 5 episodes in now. So Great Things with Great Tech is available on all your favorite podcast stations, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, basically every podcast platform there is, and also on YouTube. So please subscribe to the channels. As we look to get more into the season and talk with more great companies like Weber. So Siggy, I'm going to start back in the 90s. Who doesn't love the 90s, right? It's a great time. But, you know, and I think a company like Weber, there's a few examples of companies like Weber that's had their foundations in the 90s, but probably not a lot out there that have survived and done so well. So as I believe, Weber was founded in around about 1996 by Michael Orszar. And I did a bit of research about Michael, and he seems to have been like a techie web application developer, or he was into that sort of technology and decided to start a web hosting company as he did back in the mid-90s. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I would say around 96, he started the company, mostly focused on web design, and then started getting into some of the hosting. Around 98, and that's when he asked me to join him, and that's when we got started on the hosting side of the house.
Wow. So 1998. So okay, that's really cool. So you've been there for, well, let's do maths, 22 years, which is, you don't look like that's 22 years into anything, really. You must have been like a baby, but I guess you and I are pretty much the same vintage. So What were you doing when you first joined the company? I mean, obviously now you're CTO, but what were you doing back then? What was your role?
When I first joined, we had to set up our first servers, and so we had co-located our first two servers down in Atlanta at a hosting company called Interland. And
because you guys were in New York, aren't you? You're in New York.
Yeah, we're based in New York. Yeah. And so I basically was the tech guy. I was previously working at an ISP running their BSD servers. And, if Mike didn't nudge me, he convinced me to join him, which wasn't very difficult for him to do because he had a lot of entrepreneur spirit and just a lot of energy. And we were very close, and we just had a really good rapport. I might still be there, at that location. But yeah, so I just, when you're in the 90s and you're involved with tech, back then everything was open source, and there was no rule book, there was no manual, there was no, a lot of vendors. So we just had to wing it and do whatever we had to do to, help our customers.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's, and from my memories of back then in the sort of late 90s, the internet just starting, websites were still kind of like raw HTML, maybe a bit of ASP, but I guess e-commerce was obviously kicking up because the dot-com bubble was well in play there. So I guess you guys kind of rode that early bubble. What was it like around that crash when it burst? Did you guys get impacted, or let's talk about that leading into the 2000s.
We were okay because we weren't like one of these like crazy, like, we were all self-funded, and, we started helping friends and family and industry friends, and, our name started getting a good name. And back then it was IRC chat rooms or bulletin boards where people would say, hey, who's a good web company? It wasn't like there was Google AdWords where, people would be vying for people's attention. So that really didn't affect us too much. And that was a great example of, doing things at your own pace, your own speed, your own way, you know, sometimes is a little bit better. And I think that's one thing that sort of held true with us over the years. But it was, I got to say, it was like the Wild West. You know, we were there to be responsive to our customers. They were just, they were also in the infancy of their companies. So they were starting hosting their websites, and we would run them. And then as our customers became successful, and as their websites got busier and grew, they would look to us and say, "Hey, you know, we need to handle more traffic. We can't go down." And then we had to be like, "All right, well, how do we do that? Oh, well, there's something called load balancing. Let's go figure that out. Oh, well, you know, our customer just got attacked. You know, how are we going to prevent, you know, DDoS attacks, or how are we going to scale to multiple servers? Let's use NFS." So as our customers grew, we just grew with them, and we sort of rode the wave together, and they entrusted us with their entire stack. And there was, you know, we were certainly a managed service provider.
Like managed service provider. Okay. Yeah.
So in our mind, that meant, you know, assume anything that goes wrong is our fault. Call us first. And we have to maybe prove to you why it's an application problem or this. And so we always just assume that that's what everybody did. Not until maybe 15 years later, we sort of transition a little bit more to enterprise, like we realize, like, wow, we go really deep. Like, you know, we're on the phone suggesting code updates to our customers. Like, you know, so it took a long time to like articulate the value of that, or really for the industry to kind of draw the lines. This is this type of company. This is that type of company. But it was good to start that way. It was good to really, you know, focus on letting our customers trust us and coming to us to solve their scaling issues and taking those phone calls at 4 a.m. or whenever and being a trusted partner, you know?
Yeah, I think, and that's very reminiscent of a lot of those successful web hosting companies in that era where they were very hands-on. Customers expected that sort of hand-holding because the customers at that point just knew they needed a website to do something, right? They didn't care really about, you know, where, how it was run, what it was doing in the back end. I mean, most like today, but I think the difference back then is that there was an element of people expected a little bit of downtime, a little bit of problem, because it was so raw and so fresh. So really it was more us as web hosters dictating to the customer a little bit more than what is today, where the customer dictates to the web hoster. And you know, there's a lot more choice out there today, but I remember the early 2000s as well being pretty crazy. But so around about sort of mid 2000s, so it was probably still predominantly web hosting. So what were you guys running back then, and how many employees did you have during that early 2000 periods? And from a technology point of view, what were you running?
Yeah, so I guess in the early 2000s, we were probably 20 to 30, 40 people, something like that. 20, 30.
It's still pretty big.
So.
That's still pretty big.
Yeah, we grew pretty fast at the beginning, I would say. And the stack was mostly FreeBSD. You know, back in the day, that was sort of like the premier web hosting platform, Apache running on FreeBSD. Wow. You know, and like when we started, like this was like even before PHP was a thing, it was all running CGI. And it's funny, you mentioned e-commerce before, and I had a flashback to this product called Miva, which was this old e-commerce thing that I haven't thought about in years. But yeah, you know, it was Apache, obviously, you know, MySQL came about at some point, PHP, and NFS. So, you know, we would start building these storage servers where we'd be able to load balance and run multiple web heads and have file servers on the back end.
Where were you load balancing? Were you load balancing on a bit of Cisco kit, or what was the actual load balancers? Because it wasn't really software based back then, was it? You surely were doing it on a bit of an appliance or something.
Oh yeah. Those were the Alteons. I don't know if you were.
Okay. I was a Cisco load balancer, man. I did all my load balancing on the Ciscos. Great machines.
The Alteons were good, but I probably, you know, spent way too many nights in the data center, you know, sort of fighting with them. But I got to say, they were probably years ahead of their time with some of the features they had. But yeah, I mean, you know, those things work well until one day they break. And I mean, for us, this, you know, we started with sort of single deployments, and then like everything else, you sort of build, you know, multi-tenancy around it and wrappers for, you know, we built multi-tenant wrappers around the load balancing and the hardware. So that helps.
Yeah. I was going to say, like, I know that when we had this awesome load balancer, did everything, like everything. It was our main switch as well. Everything ran through that, all of our websites were hosting. Only it was a single point of failure because it was the only one that we had. And that's how you kind of rolled back then. You'd never do it today. But back then it was like, we've got all this high redundancy. We've got the load balancing. Unfortunately, we've just got one bit of kit that's actually driving it, you know, and it kind of bit us a little bit. But that's kind of, like you said, the Wild West of the early 2000s in the industry was crazy. And let's move forward a little bit, because I think, you know, leading up in the 2010s, I mean, obviously you guys probably got into the whole virtualization wave and started to do probably co-location and then moved into virtual infrastructure hosting. So just pre-2010, what were you guys doing then in terms of, that sort of hosting?
Yeah, so, you know, the New York City data center market is very interesting. It's sort of near and dear to my heart now. So we were the first customer in a facility called Globix, which, it's funny, talk about the dot-com era. When they opened the data center, they had this huge party at like a disco, and it was like free food and drinks, and people walked around in costumes for a data center, you know, because, you know, the company had all this money to throw at it. So we were the first customer there, and then we just sort of ended up, you know, leasing more cabinets. And in Manhattan, it's very dense, and you'll get three cabinets, you know, on one floor, and then two cabinets on another floor, and then, you know, then you're in another building, and then you're in over here and over there. So we, pre-2010, we kind of just, we had our NOC, like, in a building in Manhattan, and we had this infrastructure at 60 Hudson and 111 8th, and all these other buildings that are typical POPs, and we were kind of like running all over the place. And then we would have experiences where one data center would get acquired by another company, and then they change their tune. They don't want to sell more cabinets. They want to hike up the prices. So, you know, that started to become annoying, to say the least. So we started looking, and we were growing at that time. We probably were, I don't know, 30, 40 cabinets. So
That's quite significant, yeah. And was most of your business out of, like, customers out of New York, or were they?
No, ironically enough, it was a lot more global back then, because sort of like the generic web hosting product, especially with, you know, not a large amount of companies that were in it, you know, it was a global product, and we'd be sitting on these bulletin boards, like, I don't know if you remember Web Hosting Talk, you probably do. And people, you know, we had a lot of clients in the UK, a lot of clients in Europe, a lot of clients, you know, in Australia, all over. Today it is, I would say, more localized, but back then it was kind of global.
Wow. That's interesting. That's kind of reversed in. So that takes us to about 2010. This really intrigued me when I was doing the research here. I bumped into a bit of history where you guys basically moved in to an old building in New York. It's your flagship data center now. It's 501 Franklin Ave. And for those that are, you know, on the browsers, do a bit quick look up of 501 Franklin Avenue, and you would not think that it is a data center. It's incredible in terms of the way that it looks. It's a really old, rustic building, and it's got its beginnings pretty much in the early 1900s, hasn't it? I think it was built around the turn of that century, and it was bought in 1910 for $22,000. And then, actually, looking like Franklin Roosevelt, or Theodore Roosevelt, actually laid the first cornerstone. So tell us a little bit about this data center, because it's a fascinating kind of bit of history, I think, and ties into your history as well.
Yeah. So that building, which is 501 Franklin Avenue in Garden City, New York. So that it was built by Doubleday Press, and which used to be, I think, the largest publishing company in the world at the time. And it was built to be a printing press. And it's funny, when you talk about data centers, ironically, a lot of them at some point were printing presses because of the high floor load. So 501
Franklin,
different. And it was a large printing press, you know, at the height, there was about 100,000 books being produced there a day. And, you know, funny enough, we actually found a book that they created about the building, because they're a book company. And so we got all these interesting tidbits. And, you know, Theodore Roosevelt did lay the cornerstone there. And it ran as a printing press. And it's actually, it was modeled after Hampton's Court in England.
So I've been there. Wow, there you go. I thought I recognized it, because I was actually only there last year with my family. That's crazy.
Yeah, so it's got like the gargoyles, and it has like the gun slits like up high on the, you know, and it's funny because like on either side of us are just like normal office buildings. And then like, you're just like boring suburban office buildings. Then like you see this beautiful brick, like castle, like building.
Yeah. Cause looking at the photos, I kind of imagine it to be like almost in the countryside sort of out there. And that's why I thought it was a bit of a weird location, but it's obviously it's entombed by what is normal. But it's obviously taken this amazing sort of English kind of manor look, which is crazy.
Yeah, so it ran as a printing press for many years. A lot of cool history, a lot of cool things that went on there. And then at some point, in 2003, JetBlue.
JetBlue. Yes, I saw this. Yeah.
Yeah, so a big airline, domestic airline carrier in the United States. They leased a portion of the building to build a data center. And so they built that facility to be their global flight operations center. They built it with the use case that if it ever went down, they knew their flights, you know, would be able to take off. So they added a lot of redundancy to it. And they built a large amount of white space. They had their NOC. They had, you know, 2 6,000-gallon diesel tanks, multiple generators, static. They built all these really interesting extra infrastructure components that when you go and look at like multi-tenant colo facilities, like you don't always see these extra bits because they don't make sense for that use case. The ROI is not there. But for these guys, their use case was very specific and they're like, we don't want our planes not taking off, so we're going to go the extra miles. So because we were getting sort of like, you know, sort of tossed around in Manhattan, putting stuff everywhere, we were like, we got to find our own spot. We got to find our own facility. And we looked at a bunch of stuff in Manhattan and New Jersey, but so JetBlue, they built it. And then like after 5 years, they were like, you know what? We don't want to be in the business of managing critical data center. They're like, they got burned once or twice. Yeah. They put their systems down. And also they were switching to a different software platform that didn't need all those servers. So
isn't that typical of like, you know, you can imagine it was a direction at one point by someone who came in and said, look, we're going to build this data center. This is what we need. And at that time, you know, you could have hedged your bets rather, you know, you couldn't see the rise of public cloud like Amazon and Azure at that time. So it was like, I think it was probably the right bet to make at the time, but it just shows you how quickly it all changed within 5 years. Was like, no, we're going to go a different direction. And you guys have basically profited from that. Did you guys buy the whole building or just the data center space that was in there?
So we acquired the actual leased space. We bought the data center from them, not the building. But we do have a very long-term lease in the building. You know, we have some transatlantic fiber that connects the United States to Europe that goes through there.
It's a connectivity hub, isn't it? It's got good connectivity from what I've
heard. Yeah, we have a physical meeting room, virtual meeting room. So the facility itself is sort of critically important for a lot of the core infrastructure in the area. But you're right. It's funny that whole story about how JetBlue, you know, I don't know, dropped 30, 40 million dollars to build a facility, then 5 years later it went another direction. We use that story when we talk to our customers about, hey, why are you guys running a data center? Why are you guys taking accountability and ownership? And so it's interesting how that facility came about, that sort of decision making. But yeah, we bought it from them, and then we moved all our servers from Manhattan, and we kind of made that our new home, you know, in the New York market.
And I love the narrative that this thing was a printing press. Like back in the day, printing presses and the generation of that data, the printing of that data, it's kind of like what we do today, right? It's just in a different form. So the building in itself has undergone changes, but ultimately it's still about the creation of data, the storing of data, the replication of data. It's actually quite crazy when you think about it that way.
I've said the same thing to people, like, you know, I like to, you know, I use the word content, right? Like they were pushing out content to the world, right? And that's what we're doing. We're hosting content, and it's being pushed out to the world from the same building, just in a different, you know, medium.
That's crazy. I love that. That was one of the things I loved when I was doing my research here. All right. So let's move in and talk about the modern day WebAir, you know, from the last decade, because you guys are seeing tremendous growth. I mean, at the moment I see that you've got, what is it? Is it 5 data center locations, or what are you guys actually running at the moment?
I sometimes lose count. I think it's 8 now. So we're in New York.
Oh wow! 8. Okay, cool.
Yeah, we're in New York, Los Angeles, Montreal, London, Paris, Amsterdam, Singapore, and Chicago. We just launched Chicago.
Wow. Okay. So you guys are getting out there, and yeah. But what's your all your services, are they equally distributed, or does one data center do more? How does that kind of work?
Well, you know, New York is our flagship. It's definitely our biggest region and where we sort of have the largest presence and the most density. But all of our services are available globally.
Yeah.
Today.
Yeah, cool. And like, so servers under management, you've got about 10,000 servers. Are those combination physical and virtual, or mostly virtual?
Yeah, I'd say the number is definitely higher now. It's probably double that or more. I don't really know. But yeah, I mean, obviously it's mostly virtual. You know, there's definitely some physical boxes if there needs to be. You know, we do run, we still have a good number of sort of legacy, let's say web application type hosting who prefer bare metal, right? So like ad tech companies who are distributing ads, very low latency at the edge, you know, they prefer to run on bare metal. So we still definitely support that.
Yeah. And you, I know your background. I mean, obviously, you've done everything there, worked your way up to CTO in the company. But I know that you're very big on networking. Like, that's kind of like your passion, from what I've seen. And you know, that I think is reflected in, I think, the services that WebAir offer from a networking perspective. Did you want to talk a little bit about what you're doing with the networking technology? Because I think that's a great story there.
Yeah, I think what's interesting is, you know, going back to the data center, so networking was always important for us because if you're in the web hosting industry and you're hosting a good amount of websites, depending on the traffic profile, we ended up just for whatever reason or other hosting a lot of sites that were doing like live video streaming, like gaming sites, or pushing out a lot of video, and those are bandwidth intensive, you know. So we always had to have our multiple transit carriers and get involved with peering, and we also got involved with a lot of VoIP companies. And, you know, you talk about VoIP and gaming and video distribution, you know, if a website doesn't load, you hit refresh, right? But if you're on a phone call and you start hearing jitters or it disconnects, then that's a problem. Or if your game is getting lagging, that's a problem. So somehow we got involved with these use cases that were very network sensitive. And so we had to really bolster our network, you know, run our own public BGP. You know, I ended up getting involved with an organization called NANOG, where I got very sort of close to all the network operators in the United States.
Oh yeah, XOG. We've got something. We've got OSNOG similar here in Australia and whatnot. Yeah.
Yeah. So networking was, you know, that was always big for us. It was always important for us. And the funny thing is, when we moved into that data center at 501 Franklin, you know, we just needed a place to drop our servers. You know, we just were looking for a home where we could house our own servers, where we didn't have to deal with, you know, our colo vendor, you know, changing directions or not having enough space. We wanted more control. And, you know, for a good, I don't know, 5 to 8 years, that's what it was. It was just a place to house our dedicated servers for our web hosting, use case. But, you know, the industry definitely shifted, you know, I think in the early 2010s, obviously public cloud, and not so much public cloud, but maybe more specific hosting platforms. Like if you are a old school generic web hosting platform, you know, you can host WordPress, you can host Magento, you can host .NET, but all of a sudden you have a hosting company that pops up and all we do is WordPress and we do it amazing. And all we do is Magento. And so I think the old school web hosting companies started to feel that pressure. You know, a lot of them sort of sold or went out of business or
consolidated.
Whatever.
There's a lot of consolidation in the industry as well. Yeah.
Yeah. So one of the things was owning that physical data center, which today it's a tier 3 facility, over 400 cabinets, all the compliances, owning the data center and, you know, having the physical facility, but also having really good networking skills, like knowing how to operate dark fiber and DWDM equipment and all that. And then, you know, and then having the ability to provide storage services and compute services and firewall and networking, we kind of looked at those assets, the physical assets and our capabilities. And we're like, you know, you know, there's some other interesting things that we could be doing, like with our assets and capabilities. And we started sort of shifting into focusing on hosting on managed infrastructure for really mid-market enterprise customers that kind of, you know, where cookie cutter solutions weren't cutting it. Like now we would refer to those as hybrid, like somebody who needed, you know, a little bit of colo and private connectivity to five carriers and some private storage as a service and a private cloud and managed firewalling. And you can't really do those things without, you know, a facility or good data center assets. Yeah. You can't do them without core networking. And you can't do them without having your own cloud and storage platforms. And so we just sort of looked at what we had, in our tool belt and our engineering capability, and we just sort of applied it to solve different problems, you know. And I think that's what we've been doing really since, probably over the last 5 to 8 years, sort of focusing on, you know, pivoting where those skills are needed, you know.
So that would say, if we talk about your innovation and your services, and you know, and where you guys stand out. So what are those core innovation and services built on today?
Our stack. It's funny because part of me, it's weird. Like, you know, just being an old school tech guy, like, I almost feel like if you're not naming open source on some level, like you sold out, you know, like it took a long time to get over that, I would say. But we still do run a lot of, managed Linux machines. You know, we always had our own control panel that we wrote ourselves.
Yeah.
We always had our own software daemons inside the guest OSs that would sort of interact with the operating system.
So today that's all
Python, and so our customers, you know, going back to the web hosting use case, manage all the websites and cron and all that. But today, yeah, so a lot of it's Linux. We run a lot of Cisco and Juniper in the network. We like MikroTik. Or cloud router firewalls, Linux-based firewalls, like those are like the Swiss Army knife for us.
Yeah.
There's nothing, like, it's funny because we've been on calls with very big customers, and you know, there's been some interesting network use cases that, you know, very expensive vendors just can't deal with that these Linux routers can do. So we use those. On storage, we use a lot of Ceph, which is open source. Open source distributed storage. We use that for block, file, and object. We always ran Isilon for file storage, but we're shifting away from that. We run some Nimble for block storage today. We run some Cisco UCS and just some bare metal HPE. You know, like a lot of Supermicro. You know,
yeah.
I'd say it's pretty typical as far as the technology stack.
And what about the technologies that you're building your services on? Because obviously you guys do a bunch of services. You do. You're obviously big into the DR, backup as a service. You know, you do ransomware protection. So what are those built on? Who are your tech partners there?
Yeah, so we obviously run a lot on, you know, on VMware. And we do a lot with Veeam today, which obviously you're very familiar with. We work with some other data movers. And, you know, like the thing with what we're trying to build is really focus on building platforms and building glue. And a lot of customers that we work with are enterprise organizations that, you know, we like the customers that are like, they're like, you know, problems to be solved. It's not a cookie cutter environment. They have legacy environments. They have old platforms. So, you know, we might need a data move. We might need to do native storage replication with Nimble or with NetApp, you know, Snapmare or with Equalogic.
Yeah.
And because we have like that long history, we have our own legacy from the web hosting times. We have a lot of stuff, so we can apply those. So we're trying to really build a platform that can integrate with multiple data movers. We're using vCloud Director, which I think is a really cool platform. You know, like we were using VCD, at the very beginning, and then it kind of went away, right?
Yeah. Know the history well.
Yeah. So at that point, we kind of moved away from it. We kind of went all into KVM.
That's interesting.
Yeah, and that was fine, but the problem, you know, it's interesting you mentioned the partners, especially on the DR side. The problem is when you want to, like, you know, offer services like DR as a service, and your technology partners are doing so much innovation, like Veeam has done a ton of integrations with vCloud Director, Zerto the same, and even VMware now with their, you know, vCDA data mover.
Yeah.
And so when you want to just buy software and plug it in, you kind of have to, you know, play ball with them. And so that's why for us, VCD makes sense now. And also it makes sense because as a managed infrastructure provider, we don't need to be building, a hypervisor management or orchestration system, you know?
Yeah, because I guess KVM in itself, like it's not practical as a target for DR and replication, because effectively you need there's no one really doing it on scale or doing it well. to actually have you hosting KVM as a target where people can then, you know, replicate or copy in from VMware, from Hyper-V. The cross hypervisor there just doesn't work with KVM, unfortunately. And that's where I see that it kind of people wanted to go down that path. And I've seen that a lot over the last few years. But realistically, like you said, you've got to go back to what you can plug into the best and what makes you generate those services and effectively what makes you money at the end of the day, no matter how much you kind of want to keep to your open source, you know, background and all that kind of stuff. So that's an interesting situation to kind of play with for yourself.
Yeah, you know, like as we started shifting to that hybrid use case and the fact that our facility was so secure and you know, the fact that we could tell our customers, hey, we own the data center. It's our SOC report. We're going to own the network right to your doorstep. And it's all of our own hardware and people in the facility. It made for a really cool compliance story. It was, you know, we could sign these, we could take legal liability. It's not like someone asked for our compliance audit and we're going to Equinix or NextDC or Digital Realty and saying here's the facility that we're in. The way that we were integrating and our assets made for such a good compliance story that we started really focus on these enterprise customers, and we had to be responsive to what they were doing. So they're all running VMware. You know, they're all running these big box vendors. So you're right. Like all the open source stuff was like, yeah, that's really cool, but our customers are asking us to do X, Y, Z.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. That. And speaking of that, so I guess it leads to the next question. How do you continue to internally disrupt yourselves? How do you continue to get better, to continue to not just, you know, work off the last 22 successful years or whatever it is? How do you go and say, how are we going to disrupt for the next 10?
I don't even know. I wish I could say that we had a process around it or a method. If I had to chalk it up to anything, I'd probably chalk it up to just, the old school engineering spirit that sort of got us to where we are.
Wild and West. You were talking about the Wild West.
And, you know, like sometimes like I'll meet with customers and they'll tell us about their environment and they'll tell us about their challenges and what's going on. And one of my problems is like, I'll go all crazy scientist and I'll be like, well, you know, like we could build this and we can connect that way. And then we can do this and we can do that. And we don't have a product around it. We don't have a SKU around that, but it makes sense to the customer. It fits the bill. And so we'll go and do it a few times and then we'll standardize it afterwards. And it's the Wild West. It's always the way that we ran. And, it's interesting because today, you know, one of the ways that I like to describe WebAir is, you know, there's a lot of cloud service providers that are out there. And when you look at the core services, when you look at, yeah, we have a VPC product, we have a hosted private cloud product, maybe we manage public cloud, we have storage offerings, you know, it's all table stakes, right? It's all the same offerings.
Yeah.
But for me, it's not so much the what, it's not the what, it's the how. It's the integration. And what I like, what we like to do now is, you know, we found that a lot of customers or organizations are kind of, they've looked at cloud in a very black and white way. They're looking at infrastructure on-prem in their closet, in their own data center, or they're looking at public cloud.
Yep.
And each has their own pros and cons. And so what we've done is we've used our network assets and our ability to be flexible to give them a middle ground. And so if I can tell someone, listen, I can give you a hosted private cloud, your own vCenter environment, just like the one you had on-prem, and I can deploy it in your backyard, you know, in the metro close to you, and I can privately connect it with a private, you know, 10 gig pipe or fabric, and I can air gap from the public internet. Now you have the best of both worlds. You have something that you can operate the same technology, the same IP addresses. It's inside your network. It's low latency. So it's all the same assurances as what you had before, but you have an OpEx style service. You can hold us accountable to manage, monitor, scale and secure it. And you have that best of both worlds. So that's what's been really good for us is giving customers cloud within the existing paradigms that they've already built for their security and for their network. We don't want cloud to be like a one-off to what they've built, you know?
Yeah. So I guess what you're saying is the bespoke solutions that you might crazy scientists come up with, eventually might become a product and might become the next thing. I mean, that's kind of how this industry works, right? We work out a necessity for the clients, and then we go, hey, that's a really good idea. Let's productize that. That's going to make us some money. All right, just to kind of start to wrap up. So just, I always ask this question. So what makes a great technology partner for you? Because you guys are building your own tech on the back of great technology. A great thing is a great tech. That's what it's all about. So what makes a great technology partner for you?
Well, I think the word partner is the key there. You know, it's about technology, but it's also about people. And I'll give you an example without naming names. We work with two software companies that essentially have the same product, and one has superior technology, but from an organizational perspective, like they're dysfunctional. Like from a people perspective, it's totally dysfunctional. The other, the technology is maybe just not, it's catching up, but the organization's amazing, and the people and the support, and you know, having someone you can call and having, you know, people that you can jump into a Slack channel and look at stuff with you, is there. And so what I've learned through that experience of sort of dealing with like this stark contrast of organizations, like I'm a tech guy, like for me, I'm like, oh, it's all about technology. But going through that experience, I'm totally now in the camp of it's about people and about finding a good partner, because you can catch up on technology, right?
Yeah,
but
for sure.
changing the, you know, the culture of a company, and changing like the org structure and the people, like you just can't do that, you know? Yeah. So I think it's a lot about the people and having transparency in the partner, you know, with the roadmap, being responsive to bugs and issues. And you know, like when we talk to our customers, we say to them, like, you're not buying infrastructure. You're buying our expertise. You're buying us as a partner. You know, we're there with you in the trenches. That's what we look for on the back end from our partners.
Awesome. That's amazing. Well, man, it's been a really great conversation. I've loved the history. I love what you guys are doing. You know, love that data center. I can't get enough of that data center. And the fact that
you got to come visit.
Day I hope. I've never been to New York, right? So I want to get there eventually. Yeah. Eventually we'll get there. But yeah, thanks for that. I got that pronunciation right. You know, this is Great Things with Great Tech. This was episode 5. And just as a reminder, please subscribe to all the channels on the YouTube, on the podcast stations. And with that, we will sign off and see you next time. Thank you.